Support for Newsworthy comes from Enlivion, providing affordable housing and supportive services to help build strong foundations for a better future for hardworking families, seniors, and the disabled in Charlotte. More information available at Enlivion.com.
From 90.7 WFAE, this is Newsworthy for Thursday, April 17th, 2025. I'm Eric Teal. The North Carolina Board of Elections said in a court filing Tuesday that only 1,675 voters will be impacted by Republican Jefferson Griffin's challenge against Democratic incumbent Allison Riggs for a seat on the state Supreme Court. The board said it will require 1,409 overseas voters in Guilford County to provide photo ID within 30 days for their ballot to count. Griffin had challenged Guilford voters as well as overseas voters in three other Democratic-leaning counties, but the state elections board said it will only require Guilford County voters to provide ID, since Griffin's challenge of that county's overseas voters was his only protest completed in time, as required by state law. The board also said it will reject the ballots of 266 never-residents, voters who've never lived in the state. These could be people who were born overseas, have lived overseas, and whose parents have North Carolina residency. That's required by the state Supreme Court. With less than 1,700 voters in doubt, it could be difficult for Griffin to overcome Riggs' 734-vote lead. Last month, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced it'll scale back regulations for the wetlands it covers. As WFDD's Paul Garber reports, some conservationists are worried about the potential impact on North Carolina's waterways.
The EPA says it wants to hear from farmers and others about how federal interference impacts their land use. The outcome of those talks could lead to reductions of areas covered by the landmark Clean Water Act. Some environmentalists are concerned that reducing protections could lead to degraded waterways. Manly Fuller is vice president of conservation policy for the North Carolina Wildlife Federation. He says what may start out as a mountain bog will ultimately lead to the ocean.
So protecting waterways from the headwaters to the estuaries is really important, and the elimination of these tools to help protect those areas is, in our view, bad policy.
Fuller says the wetlands absorb pollution, provide habitat for wildlife, and slow the flow of water to reduce floods. He says their protection also supports thousands of North Carolina jobs that rely on clean water. I'm Paul Garber.
A Charlotte nonprofit has changed the name of its upcoming maternal health conference out of fear of losing federal funding. As Elvis Meneyesse reports, what was the Black Maternal Health Conference no longer includes the word black.
The local nonprofit Caring plans to host the conference Thursday at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church. It coincides with Black Maternal Health Week and highlights the experience of Black women who are three times more likely to die from complications due to pregnancy. But this year, the group has omitted the word Black from the event's title, fearing it could cost them federal funding.
If we were to allow one word to trigger those that are in charge of disseminating funds, I believe that would be a detriment to those that we're serving.
Shanavia Montgomery is the group's CEO.
We serve nearly 1,300 families with our maternal childhood programs. That is growing. I do not want to have to cease that programming for those individuals, knowing that for some of them it's life-saving over one word.
In 2023, Caring received a $1 million federal grant to help reduce infant deaths and health disparities among the uninsured or underinsured. In January, President Trump signed an order calling for the elimination of all federal funding that advances DEI initiatives. Elvis Meneyesse, WFAE News.
After 179 years as an institution of higher education, Limestone University in Gaffney, South Carolina, could soon close its doors. WSPA reports the college held meetings with students and staff Wednesday to inform them the college is facing financial uncertainty. According to a press release on the college's website, Limestone's Board of Trustees announced that unless the university can obtain immediate financial support in the amount of $6 million, the institution will need to move fully online or begin the process of closing.
The board will meet on Tuesday to discuss next steps for the institution. Limestone is about 50 miles southwest of Charlotte. The North Carolina Department of Transportation will close some roads in Kannapolis today to complete a grade separation project. NCDOT crews are working on a bridge that separates Rogers Lake Road from the railroad tracks. Southridge Avenue will be closed from 6 p.m. until 6 a.m. Friday. In addition, on Monday, crews will close South Main Street from 6 p.m. until 6 a.m. Tuesday. More than 20 post offices in western North Carolina were damaged by Hurricane Helene. Now the Postal Service says 5 will not reopen, at least not in their current location. The post office in Swannanoa, which saw devastating floods last year, is among those closures. As BPR's Laura Hackett reports, residents are already missing this important community hub.
The plaza where the post office used to operate is across the street from the Swannanoa River, which rose to 27 feet when Helene hit last fall. The property also had an Ingles, Ace Hardware, and gas station, and it used to buzz with shoppers and vehicles. But since the storm flooded the plaza, all of those spots closed and the parking lot has grown eerily quiet. And that scares some people.
I am really concerned that not having these basic services for our community could lead to the death of our community.
Tisica Shock is a longtime resident of Swannanoa.
I know that sounds dramatic, but not having the post office, the hardware store, the grocery store, these pivotal things that keep us together, that's a threat to me and my neighbors.
Shock is especially sad about losing the post office, which she used to visit several times a week to drop off checks for work and mail off handmade quilts to friends.
It's been hard to lose that little touchstone in my week. I mean, I didn't anticipate not having access to a post office having so much of an impact on me, but it does.
Ingles owns the plaza, and the company could rebuild the place, but Ingles did not respond to multiple requests for comment. A spokesperson from the United States Postal Service, Philip Bogenberger, told BPR in an email, quote, "The property owners have informed us necessary repairs will not be able to take place." Bogenberger also said the Postal Service was looking into alternate locations. Any search for a new location, he says, would have to follow a federal process that includes a study and public comment period. That public comment period may be a long way out, but people in Swannanoa are already organizing. Dan Slagle is a Swannanoa resident and retired Postal Service worker who is leading the campaign. It's a cause that's close to his heart.
Post office to me has always been like the heart of a community. We're Swannanoa, NC, and our zip code is 28778. That's a unique zip code for just Swannanoa.
Slagle says he's worried if the community does not speak up, then it may be forgotten about.
That's what my fear is, that, you know, if the community doesn't get active and be vocal, we stand a bigger chance of losing our post office, and we don't want that. We want them back home.
Slagle's campaign is making some noise. Buncombe County Commissioner Jennifer Horton says her phone has been blowing up.
I'm receiving phone calls. I'm receiving text messages. I'm receiving emails, even messages on social media saying help.
Since the post office is federally managed, Buncombe County doesn't have much control over its fate. But Horton says she's working with fellow commissioners to get more transparency from Ingles and the Postal Service about what people can expect moving forward. I'm Laura Hackett, BPR News.
The Mint Museum Randolph's African art galleries are opening again after closing for an extensive multi-year renovation. The galleries have expanded from 2 spaces to 3, and curators say they represent a broader and more honest depiction of the African art in the Mint's collection. Gwendolyn Glenn spoke with the Mint's chief curator, Jen Sudol Edwards, and guest curator, Dr. Lisa Holman, on a recent visit to the African galleries.
This is where it begins.
The entrance to the newly renovated African art galleries opens to a well-lit elongated room with honey-colored hardwood floors, track lighting and walls, and display fixtures painted in white and a vivid orange. The dominant colors in the other two spaces are a calming blue and a radiant green. This is in contrast to how they looked before the reinstallation, when the walls were all beige with mostly dark art pieces. Mint officials say they wanted to make the galleries feel more inviting. The three spaces focus on variant African art styles that include full-bodied masks used in ceremonial masquerades, sculptures, fabrics, and wood carvings. Jen Sudel Edwards is the Mint's chief curator.
The African collection has only been a part of the museum since the 70s, and it's been a slow growing collection. And so the way that pieces have come in, the way they have been displayed, hasn't always been a very focused or well-roundedly considered practice. It's been, this is a fascinating object, we should put it on view. But it was still static, and we needed to tell new stories and make these galleries more dynamic, because one of the things we're trying to do at the Mint is to show how even if objects may seem that they're old, like they were made 70 years ago, 50 years ago, 1,000 years ago, that culture is still very vital.
Edwards says she turned to Dr. Lisa Holman to help update how their African collection is displayed and to clarify the piece's origins and purpose. Holman teaches art history at UNC Charlotte and for the past several years has done extensive research on the arts in Burkina Faso and West Africa.
I went through the Mint's files for every single object in the African collections, and there is a lack of African provenance for your African objects, meaning we know who donated them. We might know where they got them from, and it's almost never named people on the continent of Africa. And this is the most common practice in museums, not to have exact provenance about creation and when it left the artist's hands and things like that, where it was made. I think the Mint was brave and kind to do this, to offer up a kind of transparency about what they do and don't know about the objects in the collection. What I've done on the labels is said things like, possibly from Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, or Cameroon, because if I don't have paperwork, if I don't know that it came from that place, I'm not telling you it did.
As part of the reopening, the Mint commissioned a life-size piece from David Sanu of Burkina Faso titled Kimi Masquerade Ensemble. It's a colorful wooden headpiece with layers of multicolored, long, shredded-looking material on the body. Kimis are worn in various African cultural, religious, and community ceremonies. Edwards and Holman say the piece is another example of how the Mint is trying to ensure that their African collection is authentic.
We knew about Sanu's background, his connection to making the masquerade costumes for the traditional dances, because Dr. Homan had been doing all of this work with him.
So he made the headpiece and he conceived of the ensemble itself, but we had a different person, a body maker, create the top and the bottom of the body. And that person has requested to remain anonymous, which is common practice in this part of Burkina Faso, because a mask is a full-bodied animated creature, not conceptually something made by a human. Even if we all know that that's the case, we're not supposed to really talk about it in public. I think what's most striking to me is that he chose the colors of the Burkina Faso flag, which are also basically Pan-African colors. There's an altar at the very top, and then on the bottom register, there is an older man, which you can tell because he has a gray beard. Mm-hmm. So what this shows us is a kind of reverence for longstanding practices, reverence for masquerade, reverence for elders, which is where we get masquerade from.
Mint officials say they want visitors to see how African art is not just a collection of ancient pieces dusted off for display, but something that is forever evolving. Gwendolyn Glenn, WFAA News.
At some point nearly every day on a television somewhere, you're likely to hear this music. That's the theme song to The Andy Griffith Show, the classic sitcom about the adventures of a small-town sheriff and his family and friends in the fictional Mayberry, North Carolina. A bill making its way through the North Carolina General Assembly would make it the official state TV show of North Carolina. To talk more about the program and its North Carolina connections is Neil Brower. He's the author of The Essential Mayberry, which was recently published in a new 25th anniversary edition. Brower also regularly lectures on the show. He spoke to our resident Andy Griffith fan, Marshall Terry.
Okay, so you are the person to talk to when it comes to the show. So for those who may not know, what makes The Andy Griffith Show so special for North Carolina in particular?
I think the main thing is that it stars one of North Carolina's favorite sons, Andy Griffith. And Andy had a real talent for knowing what was right for a small Southern town. And he had the ability to insert his ideas and his thoughts on what would make the TV Mayberry seem like a real place that turned out to be in North Carolina.
And there are references to North Carolina many times throughout the series.
There are. When the show first started, it was to be set just in the South. Andy would look at scripts, and if they were talking about a city or town in the area, it would be Capital City or some generic name. And Andy didn't like that. So he said, let's use Raleigh if we're talking about the capital.
Helen was really looking forward to going to that dance.
Oh, and you have to go to Raleigh, huh?
Yeah, I do.
Maybe a few episodes later, Siler City instead of just some other name. And it became the TV Mayberry, a town in North Carolina, from that process.
One town that was not mentioned in the series is Mount Airy, which was the real-life inspiration for Mayberry. Why was it the inspiration?
It's an inspiration for Mayberry because Andy grew up there, and that was his childhood remembrance and also as a young teenager of what North Carolina was like. And it's interesting that most of the writers, in fact, all of them, were not from the South. They were from New York, and they just had a talent and a feel for writing small-town scripts.
It's pretty easy to find reruns of the show on any given day. Why do you think it remains so popular all these years later?
I think because it's so well written. The actors are really great in their roles. It's based on love. That's something Andy thought was important, that the characters love and respect one another. And I think that draws people. There's usually a moral taught in almost every episode.
You know what I think, Paul?
What?
I think we both broke the golden rule.
I think you're right, Opie.
And it looks like a real place, the way it was filmed and produced. Mayberry looks like a real place that you could actually get in your car, drive to, and go visit.
Now, you have become this well-known authority on the show with your book and your lecture series. When did you first fall in love with the show?
I can actually remember when it was on its original run. I would watch reruns on TV all my life, but found a book in 1985 by Richard Kelly called The Andy Griffith Show. It had all of the episodes. There are 249 listed in the back. And at that time, VCRs had just come out. So I purchased one, and I decided I was going to tape every episode of a TV series. And what better series than The Andy Griffith Show, since I had every episode title in the back of the book that I mentioned. So I began taping the show every afternoon on Channel 2 out of Greensboro, and it took me a year to get all 249 episodes. But that's when it really bit me hard, this Andy Griffith fever. I realized how well the show was written, how well it was acted, and just what high standards it has.
So many of the show's plots involve Andy Griffith's character as the Sheriff of Mayberry, resolving conflicts with his sort of down-home folksy philosophy. Do you think there's a lesson in that for our society today in these divisive times we find ourselves in?
Yeah, I sure do. I think that Andy was always very diplomatic about what he said in the midst of a crisis or trying to straighten out a problem. He didn't do it by force. He didn't say, you're going to do this.
When a man carries a gun all the time, the respect he thinks he's getting might really be fear. So I don't carry a gun because I don't want the people of Mayberry to fear a gun. I'd rather they would respect me.
He led Opie to understandings in many of these type of situations. He was very kind-hearted with Barney and Otis and all the people of the town. So Andy's a good example of a peaceful leader.
All right, so what is your absolute favorite episode?
Well, that's hard, but I guess the very best one that I think really captures the spirit of Mayberry is called Man in a Hurry, where Malcolm Tucker is a business man from Charlotte. He's going through Mayberry on a Sunday morning. His car breaks down. He can't get it fixed. So he's stuck there. He's very high tension, wanting to get out of town.
I've got to get that car fixed now, today, this minute. I've got to be in Charlotte. Can't you understand that?
I couldn't do it. We're closed on Sunday.
You refuse to help me then?
Well, if it was an emergency.
It is an emergency.
But by the end of the day, he realizes there's something special here in this place, among these people, sitting on the front porch and talking with one another, making homemade ice cream, that type of thing. And he decides Mayberry is a good place to stay. So even though his car gets repaired by Gomer and Goober by the end of the day, he stays overnight.
All right. Well, it was a pleasure speaking with you, Neil. Thank you.
All right. I know why you're an announcer. You've got a very pleasant voice.
Oh, gosh, that's very kind of you. Thank you so much. Neil Brower is the author of The Essential Mayberry and a regular lecturer on The Andy Griffith Show. A bill in the General Assembly would make the show the official state TV show of North Carolina.
That bill to name The Andy Griffith Show as the official TV show of North Carolina passed the State House Wednesday. It now moves to a Senate which hasn't supported other state symbol bills. And for Thursday, April 17th, that's Newsworthy. I'm Eric Thiel.